Case number 13-1172. Fred Weaver, Jr. and Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, Inc. Petitioners versus Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, et al. Mr. Cullen for the petitioners, Mr. Pinnock for the respondents.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paul D. Cullen, Sr. I appear today on behalf of the petitioners. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal with your permission. This case began here with what I would characterize as a protective petition for review. The petitioners are seeking greater certainty and clarity with respect to the jurisdictional boundaries under the Hobbs Act for actions taken by the Secretary of Transportation. At this stage in the briefing, both the petitioners and the respondents appear to be in accord that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, but the reasoning on either side of this caption is very different.
Well, does it really matter? I mean, I wonder, you ask us to transfer it to the district. Well, since you've got the other action there, can we just sign an order dismissing the case here and let you all go litigate in the court that has jurisdiction?
That's what we would like to do. I don't think you dismiss the case here. You transfer it.
That was my
but
question.
But it does make
that
a big
difference.
Yes.
Why should we transfer it when you have the other action pending?
Because Mr. Weaver.
As opposed to dismissing it. Let me finish my question.
Certainly.
So I might have a better shot at answering them that way. Excuse me. Go ahead.
It makes a big difference what the theory for finding that there is no subject matter jurisdiction. The respondents assert that this court has subject matter jurisdiction to review systems of record notices published by the Secretary of Transportation under the Privacy Act, and that two such notices were published in 2010 and 2012. The petitioners, according to their theory, failed to file a Hobbs Act review request in a timely manner, and therefore you lack subject matter jurisdiction. If that is true, the scope of review, once this case is transferred or arrives at the district court, is either severely curtailed or perhaps even eliminated because you had exclusive subject matter jurisdiction. Their theory is wrong for two reasons. We all know that under the Hobbs Act, as it applies to the Secretary of Transportation, you must have rules, regulations, and final orders before you. And those rules, regulations, and final orders must have been promulgated under one of several specifically enumerated statutes in 28 U.S. Code 2342-3A. The Privacy Act is not among the statutes listed there. And so you have no and never did have jurisdiction over a Privacy Act challenge under the Hobbs Act, and the case should be transferred to the district court. Secondly, actions under the Privacy Act, which are at issue here, systems of records notices, do not implicate rules, regulations, or final orders. They are merely statutory notices that records exist and that procedures are available to make inquiry into those records and to challenge their validity. But they do not create those procedures. They merely announce and point to them for the public. There's a portion of the Secretary's regulations not cited in the brief, but I commend to your attention, dealing with systems of record notices. 10 CFR section 10.21D, and it describes systems of record notice and what their purpose is, and their purpose is to disclose the existence and character of the systems of record notice. Those are not rules, regulations, or final orders. So under either way, this court never would have jurisdiction to challenge anything directly under a systems of record notice. This court lacks subject matter jurisdiction over the petition Because the petition focuses exclusively on enforcement practices, not rules, regulations, or final orders. We allege that the secretary violates his statutory responsibilities to ensure accuracy. That is not any implication of a rule, regulation, or final order. The statute in question that established the
even if any regulation ends up under scrutiny for its validity, we have a ton of cases saying that after you've missed a statutory deadline for challenging a regulation, you could still challenge the regulation in the course of enforcement proceedings, which is what you picture here.
I'm familiar with those cases, and that's true. I think the department would take a more narrow view and fight us very hard on that one.
Right.
But there's no reason to go there. Our claim deals with failure to adhere to statutory standards, not regulatory standards, nothing implicating the publication of a rule, regulation, or final order. And that goes to the district court, and it will come here as an appellate matter if one or either of the parties appeals from the district court.
Is there a difference between an enforcement action and a challenge to policy?
Yes. Right now, in this peculiar federal-state partnership under the MIXAP statute, most of the final determinations are acceded to by the secretary, but they're made at the state level. And one of our claims is that the secretary has improperly delegated his responsibility with respect to accuracy, his responsibility to see that only reports of serious driver-related violations are included. And we are attacking his program and his regulatory enforcement practices. And I don't think we have to wait for him to bring an action against a driver in order to make that challenge.
I thought you pointed to the May 2012 letter as the final agency action, which would be reviewable in the district court under normal circumstances.
Certainly. You could point to that as final agency action here where a letter was actually filed. But if you look at the MIXAP statute, 49 U.S. Code 31102B1, the state is elevated to a partnership with the federal government. And if you look at the Data Q user guide, Joint Appendix page 89, it says FMCSA considers the state determination of the validity of a request for data review as the final decision on the data review. FMCSA will not unilaterally challenge state records. That, to me, suggests that it shows the improper delegation, number one.
That improper delegation question is a merits question.
It is a merits question.
It's a jurisdictional question.
Yes. But
you can't decide that, right?
You cannot decide that if you accept the fact that you lack subject matter jurisdiction. Correct.
We accept either side's view that there's no subject matter jurisdiction.
Sure.
Besides that.
You're through. You take the rest of the day off.
We got another case.
I'd also call your attention to Joint Appendix at page 139, where the FMCSA states that it is not authorized to correct state record violation information. We think that's incorrect as a legal matter. Okay? But you're not going to, when they wash their hands of all this responsibility, you're not going to get an enforcement action in the traditional sense. And so the only way we can challenge it is that this pattern and practice, which happened with respect to the petitioner driver in our case and will happen with respect to all drivers, has to be examined by the court.
Well, you can challenge it as you did by filing your letter and getting the brush off from FMCSA.
Certainly, there's nothing wrong with that approach, but I don't think you actually, in view of these two sections that I just read you, I don't think you have to wait for the brush off. They have established a policy which is crystal clear that they're not going to look at it. They're going to rely on the states.
Yeah.
So there's really, there's no exhaustion of administrative remedies available to you. It would be a futile act to try that.
Now, why is it that we should transfer as opposed to dismissing? Since
I
you
think,
have the other action pending, why do you need us to transfer this one?
Well, the driver petitioner here is not party to the other action, so his rights are still...
That answers my question.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen.
May it please the Court, Mark Pound of the Department of Justice. I represent the Department of Transportation respondents. I think everyone has agreed here that this Court doesn't have jurisdiction on the Hobbs Act over this particular case. The inquiry thus turns on whether the Court should transfer it under 1631 to the District Court.
I don't think that's the only issue. I have to say I'm fascinated by the relationship between the Department's views here and its views in the District Court. Where you argue, and I quote, thus when plaintiffs seek review of final agency action as plaintiffs claim in this case, the Hobbs Act vests exclusive jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, the significant difference between this court, this decision, this case, and the district court case is that there was actual letter by the Department of Transportation to the petitioner or plaintiffs in that case. In this case, there is absolutely nothing from the Department of Transportation in any form whatsoever with respect to...
I'm sorry.
So there's no agency action here in the slightest.
Let's assume that.
And that makes a difference.
But I still don't understand how you reconcile that sentence with your position
Well,
here.
We are trying to
you
make
say that You say that that case belongs here.
That case, if that letter is, in fact, an order... under the Hobbs Act, under subtitle 3 of Chapter 3.
You don't write it that way. That's not the way the brief appears in the district court.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I like to lay out the jurisdictional theory we have arrived at here. In our view, the 2010-2012 notices were an authoritative rule, if you will, within the meaning of 551-4 of the APA. Setting forth the agency's considered policy determination for the application of Section 31150. That 31150 falls directly within this court's jurisdiction under the Hobbs Act, because it is in part of subject.
If there is a regulation or final order.
All it has to be is a rule.
And rule, regulation, or final order.
That's correct. And in this court, in National Truck Carriers, the decision that came down in 1999, in footnote 3, expressly recognize that a rule need not be a regulation that has the final force and effect of law, because Section 551-4 contemplates other rules, types of rules, including interpretive rules and general statements of policy. That's what we have here in the 2010 and 2012 notices. Now, they were also issued under the Privacy Act.
I don't understand why the challenge to FMCSA's enforcement actions in the district court belongs here.
If you take that letter as a final order under 31150...
No, not a final. Oh, you're saying it is a final order?
That was the theory in district court. Now,
do you adhere to that theory?
You're not.
I think you can answer that.
I don't.
Judge Santel often says, give me an answer, yes or no, you can qualify it later.
I understand.
And I invite to give you the same invitation.
I would say that was the theory, and I think whatever this court decides should be addressing the jurisdictional issues de novo rather than trying to reconcile the various positions the department has taken in the district court.
Have thought it was the duty of the department to reconcile its positions
And I'm trying to do that, Your Honor, because there is a lot of uncertainty here. I would have to agree with that. So I think the court needs to put some clarity here, and it ought to do so without regard to what the agency did in the district court or otherwise, because this is a very difficult jurisdictional issue. Now, what
so I it's fair to say that the Department of Justice is not committed to the position taken in the district court.
Well, you could probably say that, Your Honor, but I don't want to bind myself to it. I'm not counsel in that case. But I will tell you that...
But you represent the United States government here.
I do, and the government's position here is outlined in the brief, is that the rules set forth in 2010, 2012, are subject to this court's Hobbs Act jurisdiction in accordance with the Hobbs Act, and that the... To the extent there is a challenge to those rules, and it's absolutely clear that this is a direct challenge to the substance of those rules.
The question is the context of that challenge, because
well,
as I said,
there is no
said to Mr. Cullen, there are loads and loads of cases saying that someone who is subject to enforcement of a rule, that he lost his chance to challenge directly because of timing, can challenge it in the course of the enforcement.
Sure, we point those cases out. But we don't have an enforcement action here, because the secretary, that would require an order of the secretary. We have no order of the secretary here.
I'm sorry, why? Well.
We nothing. We don't have anything yet.
At least I understand your position that we do not, that the May 2012 letter is not a final order. But I do not understand, I don't understand how you can argue that it is not a final agency action.
That letter is not this case, Your Honor. That's the district court
case. Okay.
And so that's separate. There are separate parties there.
But remember, so, just remind you, in district court, you staunchly argue that case belongs here.
But I would ask the court to address the jurisdictional issue on the facts that you have before you in this particular case. In this particular case, you have no letter, nothing from this Department of Transportation addressing the merits or lack thereof of Petitioner Weaver's citation in Montana. Nothing. We don't have anything that could come before this court as a final order within the limits of the Hobbs Act. That's our point in this case. Now, whether or not the letter of the district court case...
What is the line you draw between agency action and agency order? Because Mr. Cullen, as I understand it, argues that when you couple the agency's policies with the action of the Montana authorities, you have, in effect, an action of the agency.
The Hobbs Act requires a rule, regulation, or a final order. And that means something that the Secretary, in terms of an order, that means something that the Secretary of Transportation has itself issued.
How do we know that? I mean, if it's lawful for the Secretary of Transportation to delegate the whole operation to state authorities,
Your Honor, the Secretary of Transportation,
how can we ensure that the actions of the state authorities don't count?
Secretary, because one, the Hobbs Act requires an order of the Secretary of Transportation.
Yes, but if someone is acting under delegated authority from the Secretary, why isn't that the Secretary's action?
This is not a delegated authority. There is no delegation here. This is a state law administered by state officials at an entering into a database. Now, I would say at most what they would have with respect to their accuracy claim is a claim under the Privacy Act under subpart D, and they could mend the records seeking that. But that's a district court action that requires full exhaustion of administrative remedies at the district court. And only then may those, after that exhaustion, may they proceed in federal district court for failure to amend what is alleged to be an inaccurate record. They might have that claim here. We don't have that case because, one, that Privacy Act claim has never been brought. And it's certainly not before you now.
I gather from your focus on the 2012 letter that you do acknowledge that to be a final agency action.
Well, that was the theory in the district court case. That's not before
now. I'm just asking you what the position of the United States government is on that issue.
Well, we're going to modify that position to the extent that this court...
Whatever
this court decides, of course, because the jurisdictional issues the court should address without regard to what position we took in a different case now pending in district court before this case ever got here. This court's decision will, of course, be controlling. Now, the analysis we've asked this court to put...
Could you repeat what you just said?
This court's analysis in this case on the jurisdictional issue will, of course, be controlling in the district court action. The district court has stayed these actions, the district court pending that. So you ought to be looking at this not with reference to the positions we took or didn't take in district court, but from the position we're taking now, well, because this district court is
in control. Counsel, there's always the risk the government might be right in the position it took before the district court.
So we might consider
that possibility, right?
Your Honor, there is a difference here in the two cases.
I understand.
There's a letter there, and there's no letter here.
Right, I understand that.
So, but the underlying precept.
But in the district court, you argued staunchly that the case belongs here.
Well, because under plaintiff's theory, that became a final, that letter was a final order under 31-150. And the final order under 31-150 does belong here. There's no doubt about that.
So how do you draw the distinction between that final order and a final action?
Well, the statutory scheme speaks in terms of a final order.
I understand, but how do you draw the line between a final order and a final action? I understand the statute compels us to resolve that.
You have a case coming before you in January in which that distinction is drawn. Letters can be final action under the APA sometimes, and sometimes they're not. And there's a whole series of case law.
I understand that about letters, but what and final agency actions, but what about orders? It's the line between final orders and final actions that I'm interested in.
Well, again, that is a very case-by-case inquiry.
But what are the principles that govern it?
Well, the principle here is there's a final order in which speaks to an adjudication and the supposing rights and responsibilities. It's the very line that this court drew in the Blue Ridge case, where it talked about final agency actions having legal consequences that have set forth legal duties and obligations. We accept Blue Ridge. And Blue Ridge defines what is final agency action for that purpose.
The Secretary's letter finally resolves that the Secretary will not do anything about this, right?
Your Honor, what the Secretary will do in the district court after this court decides, and the district court's action stay pending this decision, will, of course, turn on what this court decides. What I want this court to do is examine the jurisdictional question without regard to whatever we happen to say in district court.
I understand that. I still haven't got any help from you on the difference between a final order and a final action.
Because it's difficult to draw that line without the concrete facts. All I can reference is the principal distinction is the one made by this court in Blue Ridge. And that's setting legal consequences and setting general duties and responsibilities. The 2012 rule at issue here and the 2010 rule at issue here are, in our views, Hobbs Act rules and should have been pursued to this court at the time within 60 days.
So let me see if I understand the argument that you're making here, because you're saying that a rule that is not a reg, that you don't have to promulgate, and people don't get a chance to comment in on, nevertheless cuts off jurisdiction if you haven't found it in 60 days.
Oh, these 2010-2012 rules were, in fact, published in the Federal Register and, in fact, were commented upon. OIDA itself commented on the 2012 rule. That's in the Joint Appendix. So there's certainly plenty of room for comment here. But the rule itself, it's not the same thing as a binding court regulation.
It's not a regulation.
It's not a regulation. It's a rule. And the Hobbs Act contemplates rules. And this court held and stated in National Tank Truck Carriers that a rule doesn't necessarily have to be a binding rule with the full force and effect of law. Rules can be a general statement of policy. That's what these are. These are a statement. This is an authoritative, published in the Federal Register, action by the agency saying, this is how we're going to administer 31-150. These are the things we're going to do. We're going to give the employer 3 years' worth of violation data and 5 years' worth of crash data, precisely the policy that they attack here. We're going to not second-guess what the states do when the states administer their own laws and populate the database, precisely the action that they're challenging here. OIDA was a party to the 2012 rule. It filed comments. It filed comments on parts of the rule that they now attack. They had actual notice. They could have filed a petition for review in 2012. They declined to do so. They're now stuck with that.
Does your argument here depend on whether the litigants have actual notice?
No, it doesn't, because this was published.
The SORN rules wouldn't require that, right?
No, actual notice certainly obviates the lack of any other notice, since you don't even have to reach it.
But you're saying this is a rule which ought to be have jurisdiction under the Hobbs Act, right? And the 60-day cuts you off.
Correct.
So even if you didn't have actual notice, would that nevertheless be the
rule? Well, yes, because that's the Federal Register notice that both rules had. Both rules were published in the Federal Register. Both rules opened themselves up to comments by the industry. OIDA certainly isn't ignorant of that. They're a frequent flyer in this area of law. So they know about these rules.
So the case that is in the district court now, you say that's should be here because that's a final agency action.
Well, final agency order.
Final agency order.
Because all right. That is, plaintiffs are construing that to be a final agency order.
So can they bring that here now?
No, unless they do so within 60 days. That's the bright line rule that comes with all jurisdictions.
I thought you were focusing on the difference between the district court action and this. That in the district court, the May 2012 letter was at issue.
Yes, but there's nothing like that here.
Yes, but I'm asking you about that case. That case that's in the district court now, which you say is appropriately Hobbs Act jurisdiction and should have come to us first. Could they file that now?
It depends on what they're challenging, because if they are challenging the substance of the rules, then it's probably barred completely. If they're challenging this order that arises under 3101.
Why is that?
Well, because the Hobbs Act gives you jurisdiction only certain subsections of Title 49. For example, a Privacy Act claim isn't properly brought before you in the first instance because it doesn't arise under...
I thought you were saying if their case involved an attack on these, I guess, 2010 and 2012, what are the dates of the rules?
Yes. If they are challenging the rules, the policy set forth in those rules, then they've had to employ the Hobbs Act to do so. Because those rules are governed by the express jurisdictional provisions of the Hobbs Act.
I mean, how do you reconcile that with the cases that essentially say that when you're in the course of an enforcement action, that you are attacking a regulation under which the enforcement occurs?
The district court action is not an enforcement action. It's a lawsuit by plaintiffs against the department, not a lawsuit brought by the department in an enforcement action against the plaintiffs.
It's an attack.
That's an enforcement action means where the agency has affirmatively acted to. Otherwise, you're bypassing the 60-day limitations of the Hobbs Act.
Yes, but all those exceptions, like functional music, a 1958 case, and NLRB Union, all those cases essentially say that the time limits on the challenge to the rules does not apply in the attack on the application of those rules.
Doesn't say quite that, Your Honor. Your Honor is wrong on that. What they say, and most recently in the Jim case, is that in an enforcement action, you can challenge the substance, but not procedural.
Yes, I agree with that.
You can challenge an enforcement action. To be an enforcement action means the agency has to act to enforce the law against the individuals. That's where the agency is the plaintiff, not in some sort of subsequent lawsuit.
I think you'll find enforcement is has a broader scope.
Well, because otherwise, if you define it the way Your Honor is talking about it, you basically got at the 60-day limitation, which this court and NRDC and NLRB Union and in Jim said has to be respected. Otherwise, you're allowing plaintiffs to basically rest on their rights and sue whenever they feel like it.
How would you ever have an enforcement action by the Secretary under this statutory scheme?
The Secretary enforces this against riders, the regulations and other provisions of this that the Secretary has issued all the time. It does so through the states, but
The states do that.
There are federal officers who bring enforcement actions, and those enforcement actions are subject to trial proceedings under 49 U.S.C. Part 336, I believe.
Okay.
And there is subsequent judicial review of those.
What I'm asking you about is in a circumstance like what has happened to Mr. Weaver, where the citation is issued by a state official, the decision is made by a state official, how would you ever have an enforcement action by the Secretary?
You can't buy it if it's issued by a state official. Now, if it was a federal officer and DOT has...
So, in other words, the circumstance that we have in front of us right now,
you have
there is no possibility of the traditional enforcement action which would allow them to challenge the application.
And that's a consequence of Congress's decision under 31150 and these other provisions that we've identified to partner, not supervise, but partner with the states, so the state laws are, quote, compatible, but they're not necessarily the same. This is state law enforcement. They could have brought suit in state court under the state APA, to challenge the decision of Colonel Moore and his refusal. I mean, this is all Montana has a counterpart to the APA in their state law. They have full remedies there. They could, if they allege, for example, that this has resulted in an inaccurate record of the agency, the database, which they say, they have a privacy right claim that they have to exhaust.
But there is no federal way of reviewing what's happened to Mr. Weaver, in your view.
In this particular case, no, because there's no action by the Secretary of Transportation.
That seems to be what Judge Brown said.
And she's correct in that. And that's why you have to dismiss this, because this is not an enforcement action.
Our cases also cover applications of rules.
I don't think your recent cases talk about that. They make a distinction.
Maybe they only involved enforcement.
Well, the court has refused to entertain non-enforcement action. The GEM was not an enforcement action, for example. You have to be able to look at what the purpose underlying the 60-day limit is. If you allow plaintiffs to sue whenever they feel like it, then the 60 days is a nullity.
No, it isn't.
Well,
because what the 60-day limit does is to force, is to deny the party who has failed to exercise those rights the opportunity for a facial challenge. They're not a nullity.
Well, it is a nullity.
Our cases on this would be completely incoherent if it were a nullity.
That's right. And what the
you're saying our cases
it would be incoherent if you allowed, but it would be very incoherent if you allowed plaintiffs to bring suits in district court challenging whatever the Secretary has done without regard to these regulations, challenge the very regulations that were before you, the very rules that impose the things that they're challenging. The example, their challenge to the non-serious driver violations, that's a direct challenge in this court. That's a direct challenge in district court. That belongs here. Now, they should have brought that within 60 days. If you allow them to sue whenever they feel like it in district court.
Nobody said they could sue whenever they feel like
it. That's what you have to
do. I don't understand that to be the proposition at all. Mr. Weaver actually suffered damage here. He is actually an injured party.
Your Honor,
he may be right or he may be wrong, but he's not claiming the right to sue whenever he wants to.
Well, then in the enforcement action, then that may be challenged. But we don't have an enforcement action by the Secretary.
He falls between all the stools and he gets no federal remedy at all.
He gets no federal remedy, but he
and the state cannot act against the Secretary, right?
The state can act against Colonel Moore. He's the one that made the entry onto the state database. He certainly can act against them. And to the extent there's an inaccurate record that results from this, he has a Privacy Act claim that's a federal claim. But he has to exhaust those. Because this court certainly doesn't have jurisdiction over that, neither does the district court until there's exhaustion. There are remedies. They have to dot the I's and cross the T's and do it properly. They didn't here. And this
I thought you had answered Judge Brown's question that he couldn't get the federal court on this.
He can get the federal court on the Privacy Act claim. Okay. No one's suggesting here that the Privacy Act has been repealed by 31150. But to do so, you have to proceed in accordance with subsection D of the Privacy Act and seek a correction of records. The big claim that they're arguing here before you now is our records are inaccurate. Well, they're not. We don't think they are. But if he really feels that way, there's a regulation, 49 CFR 10.41, that says, request for correction of records. Make it. We will consider it. Then you'd have an internal appeal. That's agency. It's laid out in the Privacy Act. Then that case can be brought in district court under the terms of the Privacy Act. You can't consider it now. District court can't consider it now. This court has held in Hale versus U.S. Air Force, for example, that the
Can we decide whether the district court can hear it now? If we say that if there is jurisdiction, it's in the district court, and the action then goes to district court, isn't that the extent of our opinion?
What you can decide.
Don't you have to still go down to the district court to talk with them about whether they've got jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. What I would prefer that you decide is that the 2012 and 2010 rules were subject to the Hobbs Act, that they are now barred from further review by virtue of the 60-day limitation, because the attacks that we made here are attacks on those rules. And to the extent that there's an enforcement action, then you may argue, but even then, you have to have an enforcement action by the Secretary in the enforcement action, not a separate lawsuit where the plaintiff is actually attacking it. Respectfully, Judge Williams, I simply do not agree that you can allow plaintiffs to institute their own suits, challenging whatever the Secretary has to do in the absence of an enforcement action by the Secretary. To the extent that hasn't resulted in an inaccurate record, they have a Privacy Act claim. And that will resolve all of this in terms of whether or not there will be, in fact, an inaccurate record. I would urge the court to do that and make sense of the statutory scheme in such a way that respects the jurisdictional boundaries established by Congress. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cullen had no time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Point number one, there is federal action here, even without a formal letter by FMCSA. By statute, MCSAP states, people who get the grants, are designated as partners of the federal government. And this is the official policy of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration with respect to actions of its partners found at Joint Appendix 89. FMCSA considers the state's determination of the validity of an RDR, Request for Data Review, as the final decision on the RDR. The RDR is a decision under the so-called Data Q program, which is a federal program. So what FMCSA is saying here is that they accept state action as its action. They're partners, and we have made a formal statement available to everyone that we accept state final determinations as our determination. That is federal action any way you look at it. Systems of record notices producing rules, that is completely erroneous. The statute requires notification, and that's what a systems of record notice does. Under the agency's own regulation, as I pointed out, it points out the existence and character of the records. Every time they make a casual reference in a systems of record document to the rights to review, the rights to correct, that is not quite in accordance with what others might view the statute as, you're going to wind up with a Hobbs Act challenge in this court. But that determination, those casual comments made regularly in these systems of record notices are not rules. Where do they appear in the Federal Register? Where do they appear in the Code of Federal Regulations? Where are they promulgated as a rule?
No. Counsel said that, in fact, the association here had actual notice and did comment. So why shouldn't you be held to the 60-day limit where you actually knew what they were doing?
Because we chose not to challenge a notice. A systems of record notice. There was no rule, there was no regulation that offended us enough to challenge it. There simply was nothing there. If we decided to challenge something, it would have to be, in this court certainly, it would be a rule, regulation, or final order, and so there was no need to file anything following these statutory notices. No reason. If we did so, the government would be up saying that you have no jurisdiction, this is just a statutory notice. I almost guarantee that that's what their position would be. The Ninth Circuit, in a case we cite, Lewis versus DOL, came to the same conclusion, and the agency's own regulation, 10.21D of Title 10 of the CFR, it says it discloses the existence and character. It is not a rule,
or a regulation or a final order. But what the agency does when someone files a data queues challenge and is rejected by the state under the official policy stated in the manual, the federal government adopts it as its own. That's a question of, is there final agency action, which it goes to the district court. The question before this court is it a rule, regulation, or final order? Once you decide that, whether or not there is finality there is something that probably should go to the district court. But our position in the district court would be FMCSA's partner made this decision, and FMCSA has officially sanctioned those decisions and made them their own, and they have repudiated any authority on their part. This is at Joint Appendix 139, repudiated any authority to challenge that. That is federal action, and it also violates the delegation business, but that's a merits question.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Powell.